This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When the Seattle Seahawks and the New England Patriots go at it in Super Bowl 49, the broadcast booth will be anchored by a man who's done play-by-play in 8 previous Super Bowls. Al Michaels is currently the announcer for NBC's Sunday Night Football, but that's just the latest assignment in a broadcast career that dates back to the 70s. Michaels is the only broadcaster to have done the World Series, the Super Bowl, the NBA Finals, and the Stanley Cup Final, not to mention the Olympics, the Triple Crown, and plenty of more obscure events. We invited Michaels in to talk about the big game, what it takes to do good play-by-play work, and his new memoir about his life in sports. It's called You Can't Make This Up: Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. Well, Al Michaels, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start by talking about the craft, what you do. And I thought we'd begin by just listening to a play. This is a couple of weeks ago, the AFC divisional playoff game between the New England Patriots and the Baltimore Ravens. The Patriots pull off a trick play, and let's listen to your call.
Edelman in motion. Edelman takes the swing pass. Edelman's going to throw. Deep downfield, wide open. Amendola, touchdown.
And that's a day at the office for Al Michaels, I guess. but people take a play-by-play broadcaster, take his work for granted, but there's a lot going on there. I mean, you have to describe the action as the fans see it. You can't stumble. You have to know the names of those two players, Julian Edelman and Danny Amendola, and also kind of let the emotion match that of the audience. You want to just take us inside the booth a bit and talk a bit about what goes into calling a game well.
Well, Dave, I think you summed it up perfectly by saying, you want the emotion to match what was being said. And I've always felt that the game itself is pretty much a melody, and I am there to provide the lyrics. And so you want the lyrics to match the melody, because if you are composing a song or recording a song, it's cacophonous if they don't match. And I've always kept that in mind. And I think one of the differences between, for instance, radio and television is that on radio you can use a lot of verbs because you are painting the entire picture for the listening audience. They can't see anything, obviously. But on television, they can see it. So very often you don't need verbs. You don't need the very descriptive phrases that you would on radio, because people can see what they see, obviously, and you are there to supplement it. So in that particular instance, you just have to be ready for anything. And I've been around for a number of years and have done a ton of games, and not that I was expecting that play necessarily, but you're ready. And when Brady threw it out to Edelman, it was a long enough pass. It gave me time to know exactly what they had intended to do. It was a backward pass, which meant that Edelman could throw it. I could see Amendola streaking down the left sideline, and that was that. So I think what you try to do is match the moment and be economical. And I find myself, as the years go by, speaking more and more in ellipses, because I think that helps to match the picture.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you mentioned that, because you don't say Amendola streaking down the sideline. You just say Amendola wide open, and people can see it. The broadcast team is typically a partnership. There's the play-by-play guy, that's you, and then there's a color analyst, typically a former player or coach. And your partner on Sunday Night Football, Chris Collinsworth, I actually do think you guys are the best on television, because I am amazed at what Chris Collinsworth sees in a play without the benefit of a replay or looking at film, just an interior block. I mean, there are 22 guys moving on every football play. It's amazing what he sees.
Let me tell you, it's amazing to me too, Dave, because I've worked with a lot of people, and over the last, 13 years, I've been lucky enough to work with maybe the two best of all time. John Madden, who really changed the role of the analyst when he started out and created a template and then spawned a whole bunch of imitators, and Chris Collinsworth, who to me is as good as it's ever gotten. And Chris has the ability, you're right, to see things that nobody else sees. And one of the reasons he's able to do that is that he doesn't watch the ball. He lets me do that. I will describe the play. The audience is watching that. He's watching other things. And I know one of the things he's talked about is watching the offensive line. Because the offensive line, when the play begins, and not only that, even before the play begins, the way they're set up, sometimes it's an unbalanced line, they will tell you what's going to happen. So right off the bat, he knows where to look. He looks at that. He looks at what the line is going to do and then kind of fans out from there. But he has a tremendous ability to see everything, to understand everything. And I've said this before. If Chris Collinsworth wanted to be an NFL coach, he'd be one of the five best in the league right off the bat.
Hmm. You've worked with a lot of color analysts. Tell me what a bad color analyst is like. You can mention names if you want to.
Well, fortunately, I've been doing the prime time on the NFL for the last 29 years. So when you get to that point, you're not going to get somebody who really doesn't have a certain amount of goods. But you know what? You have to learn to communicate. And the greatest people, I mean, the most successful people in broadcasting, no matter whether it's sports or talk radio or comedy or whatever, they know how to connect to the audience. And fortunately, most of the guys I have worked with, and women, have understood that. They know how to connect. They know how to take very complicated things and make them understandable without insulting the intelligence of the people who do understand the complicated aspects of football. And what really makes some of these people tremendous is they understand what everybody else on the crew is doing. We have 70 people every week at minimum who are involved, from tape operators, obviously the producer and the director, to associate directors, to sound people. There are a lot of people who go into making Sunday night football what it is and what it looks like and what it sounds like. And the great thing about, you take somebody like Chris as an example here. If he wants to go someplace on a replay, he can almost code it to the extent when he begins to talk. They're so smart in the truck. And Fred Godelli, our producer, Drew Esikoff, the director, the tape folks and all of that, they can hear Chris say three or four words and know, hey, you know what? Chris wants to go here. And they can get him there within a few seconds.
Like if he's saying, look at this great block right by the pulling guard, they will
even
go to that
piece of tape. He doesn't even have to say that. He can begin to talk about something that may have happened in the matchup. He said, you know, one of the more interesting matchups here was so-and-so against so-and-so. Right off the bat, when he says the matchup, in the truck, they're going, hey, we know where he wants to go. And they get him there very quickly. And that's something that very few people at home really understand or know about. But boy, it's when that happens and everybody's folded in together, I mean, that's the essence of this business. It's phenomenal.
Al Michaels' new book is You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. You grew up in Brooklyn, right?
I did.
When did the sports bug get you? From birth?
Well, I guess it did. The first thing, Dave, I can remember in life is my father taking me to Ebbets Field. And the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn at that time. And how many kids could grow up in an environment where you could walk out of your apartment building and walk to a Major League Baseball game that included people like Jackie Robinson, Pee Wee Reese, Duke Snyder, Roy Campanella, Sandy Koufax coming up Don Drysdale. This was my youth.
Wow.
And so when I walked in, I'll never forget walking into Ebbets Field with my father. I must have been, I'm guessing, six. And I mean, my mouth must have just dropped. The jaw must have hit the ground, because it was beautiful. The grass was so green. The Dodger uniforms, in the words of Vin Scully through the years, wedding cake white. The signage on the outfield walls. I mean, Ebbets Field was just the most wonderful ballpark in the world. And the Dodgers were my team. And I could walk to the game. And they played a lot of day games in those years. So I saw a lot of games. And when I was a kid, all I kept thinking about is, man, I want to be here every day. How do you get to be here every day? And then, broadcasting, my father was in the business at that particular time. He was a very young man. I was born when my parents were 18 years old, and he was an agent, an up-and-coming agent in Manhattan, but loved sports. And so I sort of gravitated toward broadcasting. And what better way to combine broadcasting and sports than to become a play-by-play announcer?
When did you start practicing? Yeah, when did you start practicing on your own?
Well, I practiced when I was a kid. I was probably announcing Strat-O-Matic games and APBA baseball and all the card games. And my father brought home this the APBA game where you had dice and cards. And they tried to make it as realistic as possible.
Kind of a predecessor of fantasy games, yeah.
Correct. You could play it against somebody, or you could play it by yourself. And I probably was announcing some of those games in my mind. And then we moved to Long Island for a year and a half before we moved to California. We were out in North Belmore, and we had a backyard. And my brother, who was 4 years younger than I am, you know, would pretend to be the athlete, and I'd take the garden hose and start announcing into the garden hose. So it goes all the way back to very early in life, Dave.
All right. Now, you went to Arizona State for college and had your eye on being a broadcaster, and I know you were announcing a lot of school games. After school, you were back in California, worked for a couple of TV shows, and then your big break was working for a minor league club in Hawaii. Is it the Hawaii Islanders? Do I have that right?
It was AAA Pacific Coast League, 1968 through 1970.
After your time in Hawaii, you became the regular broadcaster for the Cincinnati Reds and then the San Francisco Giants, and you increasingly got tapped for national work, and you did all kinds of stuff. I mean, ABC's Wide World of Sports, you did football, you did basketball, you did boxing. Which sports are the hardest to do?
Well, I think the hardest – hockey is actually the hardest sport,
I think,
to announce. It is, because there's so little scoring. I mean, hockey on radio – I think is the most difficult because in basketball, you know that one team has possession and you can see a game that is being called on radio in your mind's eye. In hockey, the puck is moving so quickly and it's going from one zone to the other, and you might have four or five different players touching it over a 10-second span, you know, two or three guys from one team, two or three guys from the other team. That's difficult. So I would say hockey is the most difficult of the sports to do. Now, I've also done, you know, crazy stuff like motorcycles on ice, which we did in Insel, West Germany, which featured a lot of Eastern Europeans at that time, Soviet riders, and I'd say the arena or the rink where they had speed skating competitions normally would hold about 15,000 people. And so you had 15,000 wild and woolly West Germans and Austrians would come across the border. And tailgating for motorcycles on ice, which began at 8 o'clock at night, would start at about 2 o'clock in the parking lot. And it's the schnapps capital of the world. So by the time the riders get going at 8 o'clock, I mean, everybody's pretty well lubricated. And what you have is a bunch of guys riding motorcycles on an ice track, and spikes are protruding. So it was wild. It was the craziest thing I ever saw.
Spikes are protruding from what?
From the tires.
So that's how they grip the ice. Okay.
That's how you grip the ice. You have spikes coming out of the tires, and then the guys are going around a speed skating track. It was, as I recall, it's a quarter mile. And probably eight or nine guys in a race. It was crazy. And I remember thinking, this would be great in America. I even thought about, hey, I got to get a hold of somebody and see if we can promote this thing in the United States. But it's probably one of those things where, you know, you watch it one time and go, oh, my God, this is fabulous. The second time, it's not so fabulous. And the third time, you're done with it.
Well, I guess we should talk about the call you are best known for. And this was 1980, the Olympics, the American amateur team against the Soviet, essentially professional team. An incredible shocker, which the Americans won. And we've got – the sound quality isn't all that great, but we'll hear the last few seconds and the call that everybody remembers.
The Legionov gets checked by Ramsey. McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
And the Americans win the shocker. Your line, do you believe in miracles? Where did it come from?
My heart. Somebody once wrote, it probably was the 9-year-old in me coming out. I'll buy that. I think that's what it was. You know, I was just trying to call the game to the end. The chances of the U.S. winning the game in my mind were next to zero. I was working with Ken Dryden, one of the great goalies in the history of professional hockey, and Ken had just retired, and Ken had played against the Soviets. Ken and I had gone to the Soviet Union to watch them play in a tournament. We'd seen them a number of times. If they won a game 4-0 or 4-1, it seemed like it was 20-0. They were toying with teams. They were fantastic. And we just were hoping that the U.S. could stay close for a period and a half. At least the score would sound close. And then to have that happen on that night, when you think about that game, the U.S. had to overcome three deficits. They trailed 1-0, 2-1, and 3-2, tied the game, and then Mike Ruzioni scored with 10 minutes to go, and they held on to win it. The Soviets outshot the U.S. 39-16, so most of the game was played in the U.S. end, and Jim Craig had an unbelievable night, the goalie keeping the team in the game. And so as that game is winding down and all of this is happening, even at the end it was like, I'm thinking, this is impossible. This can't be happening. But the crowd is going crazy. We're on a platform in the front of the balcony, and the building feels like a 6.0 earthquake. The guys in the truck are screaming indecipherable gibberish into my ears. And all, I was like a horse with blinkers. Call the game, call the game. And then with a few seconds to go, when the puck came out the center ice, it enabled me to say something apart from just doing the play-by-play. And the word that popped into my head was miraculous. And miraculous got morphed into a question, do you believe in miracles? Answered it with yes, and probably didn't say anything for another 45 to 60 seconds, whatever it was. But, Dave, all I was doing at the end of that game is calling the game to the end. And somebody said, oh, you must have thought about that line before. And I said, yeah, right. Can you imagine thinking about that
right,
line?
I was predicting
and then,
that, right.
And then how about if the Soviets would have scored with 2 seconds to play, and I'm blurting that out. Now, how stupid would that have sounded?
You're going to be broadcasting your 9th Super Bowl. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What are the interesting storylines in this one?
Well, this one has a ton. You've got two great quarterbacks, each with Super Bowl rings, Brady with 3 and Russell Wilson with 1, but disparate styles. You have two chess master coaches in Bill Belichick and Pete Carroll. And, of course, the irony is that Belichick succeeded Carroll when Carroll got fired after the 1999 season in New England. Two tremendous running backs who have very similar styles, who are like bulldozers in LeGarrette Blount for New England and Marshawn Lynch for Seattle. You have the Patriots, who've been the team of the 2000s but haven't won a Super Bowl in 10 years, going to their 6th under Belichick. Now you've got Seattle trying to do what New England was the last team to do, win back-to-back Super Bowls. You've got Richard Sherman, who's always quotable and is a tremendous player. You have Darrell Revis, who's as good a cornerback as there is in football on the other side. So no matter where you look, you're going to have a story. And to me, it's funny how fans sometimes think and accuse announcers of rooting. The only thing we root for is high drama. Drama, excitement, controversy, a lot of great strategy that we can mull over. And the only thing at the end of the day I'm rooting for, Dave, is overtime. I'd love to be able to do the first ever Super Bowl overtime game. There have been 48, and none of them have gone to a fifth period. And as long as it goes to overtime, it might as well go to triple overtime and be the longest game ever played. That's what I hope will happen on Super Bowl Sunday.
A piece in the Boston Globe recently said that you at age 70 are at the top of your game. And I have to say, I mean, you're still incredibly smooth. You're doing this, you know, as good as anybody out there. You've seen announcers who age and start to lose a step, and I wonder, do you think about that? Do you wonder if you'll know when it's time to scale back?
Well, I try not to do the math. Number one, even though I have a very very mathematical head, there are days when I feel like I'm 18 years old. I still have a little rascal in me. I love to laugh. I've got a fantastic wife and great friends, and everything's very enjoyable, and I'm lucky and a great family. I would say this, Dave. I would say if I can't do it the way I've done it and the way I'm comfortable doing it and where I feel like, you know, my brain is on top of things and I can assess very quickly and do it the way I want to do it. As long as I can do it in that manner, fine. If I begin to sense that, you know what, I'm not getting there as quickly as I did, I'm making mistakes, I think I'll recognize that before most people. And if it happens, that will be the telltale sign, okay, enough already. I'm not looking forward to retirement. I'd rather avoid it if I could. But I am not going to be one of those people who, in any walk of life, who's just going to hang on and do it despite everything else that's going on around them. I hope I'll know when it's time. And when it is that time, I think back to John Madden.
Sure.
And John, I think it was 70, maybe 3 or 74. We did a game. We did the Super Bowl in 2008, Arizona-Pittsburgh, which was a phenomenal game. I had no idea that John was going to retire. 3 months later, it turned out to be that was the last game John did. And then John decided in April, you know, that he was going to retire. And when they said to John, well, why? He said, it's time. It's time. And it was perfect. You know what? And I hope that'll be the case with me at some point. I don't know when, but that'll be the case. It's time.
Al Michaels' new memoir is You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. He'll be calling his 9th Super Bowl on February 1st with his NBC partner Chris Collinsworth. Slater Kinney is one of the most widely praised rock bands of the last 20 years. The band formed in the mid-90s in Olympia, Washington, and went on to record 7 albums. The group began an indefinite hiatus in 2006, but recently reunited to release a new album called No Cities to Love. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's a strong comeback.
Hey, darling, you're not home. This is your phone, though, right? Explanations are there.
The thing that comes from fame is mediocrity, sings Corin Tucker on that song, Hey Darling. That assertion is debatable. I can think of quite a few other things that can come from fame. But Slater Kinney doesn't have to worry about mediocrity. Famous within a nexus of cult stardom and critical acclaim, the band has come roaring back with a confident urgency that is exhilarating to hear. That's Price Tag, a song whose lyric is about people working low-paying jobs in our dodgy economy. The words tell the details. Corin Tucker's voice communicates the frustration and pain. Tucker has always been an extraordinary vocalist. She has a huge voice that cuts across the guitars and drums like a scraper chipping away ice on a car's windshield. Words frequently disappear when they emerge from Tucker's throat. It helps to hunt down lyrics if you want to know what a song is about. Although most of the time, the song is really about the sound of Corin Tucker's voice, whatever bold or agonized or joyous sound it's making.
Throw me a rope, give me a leg,
"Only Together Do We Break the Rules" goes the chorus of that song, Surface Envy. The second line makes a crucial shift, changing break to make the rules. Powered by Brownstein's guitar and Weiss's drumming, Slater Kinney forms a three-person collective that makes its own rules about how a song is constructed, how much of a structure it needs to work as rock and roll, and how little it takes to explode that structure. On their best songs, and there are quite a few here, Slater Kinney music consists of irreducible chunks of melody, riffs, and noise. Few bands reform with their power as intact as Slater Kinney have. Fewer still brag about their power and make the claim something more than a brag. Slater Kinney disbanded in 2006, its members have done other projects. Brownstein co-created the TV comedy Portlandia with Fred Armisen. Weiss was the drummer in, among others, the band Wild Flag. And there's been a good group called the Corin Tucker Band. But with an album like No Cities to Love, it seems as though there's no work these women do that is more important, more enjoyable, and more challenging than the music they create as Slater Kinney. I'm really looking forward to seeing them when they start their tour.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the new album from Slater Kinney, No Cities to Love. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Post-traumatic stress disorder is now the fourth most common psychiatric disorder in the United States, according to our guest, David Morris. He brings more than an academic interest to the subject. He struggles with PTSD symptoms himself. Morris was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps in the 1990s, where he saw no combat. But when he became an embedded journalist in Iraq and Afghanistan, he witnessed horrific death and injury and was nearly killed himself when a military Humvee he was riding in hit an IED. When he returned to the States, Morris began researching PTSD and how it's affected not just combat veterans, but rape victims and survivors of other trauma, including natural disasters. David Morris has written for Slate, Salon, The Los Angeles Times, and The Nation. His new book, The Evil Hours, is an exploration of the history and science of PTSD, as well as an account of his own experience and treatment. When I spoke to David Morris, he began with the reading in which he reflects on the nature of trauma.
We are born in debt, owing the world to death. This is the shadow that darkens every cradle. Trauma is what happens when you catch a surprise glimpse of that darkness, the coming annihilation not only of the body and the mind, but also seemingly of the world. Trauma is the savagery of the universe made manifest within us, and it destroys not only the integrity of consciousness, the myth of self-mastery, and the experience of time, but also our ability to live peacefully with others, almost as if it were a virus, a pathogen content to do nothing besides replicate itself in the world, over and over, until only it remains. Trauma is the glimpse of truth that tells us a lie, the lie that love is impossible, that peace is an illusion. Therapy and medication can ease the pain, but neither can suck the venom from the blood, make the survivor unsee the darkness, and unknow the secret that lies beneath the surface of life. Despite the quixotic claims of modern neuroscience, there is no cure for trauma. Once it enters the body, it stays there forever, initiating a complex chemical chain of events that not only changes the physiology of the victims, but also the physiology of their offspring. One cannot, as war correspondent Michael Hare testifies in Dispatches, simply, quote, run the film backwards out of consciousness, end quote. Trauma is our special legacy as sentient beings, creatures burdened with the knowledge of our own impermanence. And our symbolic experience with it is one of the things that separates us from the animal kingdom. As long as we exist, the universe will be scheming to wipe us out. The best we can do is work to contain the pain, draw a line around it, name it, domesticate it, and try to transform what lies on the other side of that line into a kind of knowledge, a knowledge of the mechanics of loss that might be put to use for future generations.
Well, David Morris, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you bring a literary perspective to this subject, as well as, you know, a review of scientific understanding and personal experience. And I thought we'd talk about what you experienced as a correspondent embedded with American troops in Iraq. And why don't you tell us about the incident, the most traumatic incident, I suppose, where you were in a Humvee on that patrol?
Well, this was during the height of the surge. Fall 2007, it was the end of a four-month period of embeds, and so I was just kind of generally exhausted and had just left this really bad neighborhood in Baghdad known as Dora, which had taken some of the – one of the unit I was with there had taken as many casualties as any unit I embedded with. And so I went out for what I thought would be one of my last embeds and my last embed in Baghdad in this neighborhood known as Sadia. And we were just out on a patrol, and we got a call from headquarters that we needed to go look at this street that was on fire. And it was a predominantly Shia neighborhood, and they were burning down – the Shia were burning down the houses of presumably their Sunni neighbors. And when we got there, there was smoke pouring over us, and it was kind of like – driving into it was kind of like driving into a cave, and all the light just kind of became a little sepia and darker as we got into it. And once we got in there, we realized we were in a cul-de-sac, and the Bradley armored vehicle ahead of us started to turn around, and the whole patrol started to pivot and do a 180. And as we were back, as my Humvee was backing up, we ran into an IED that blew up half the rear half of the Humvee and lit it on fire, and so there was smoke pouring into the cabin. I didn't know it until much later, but everybody in the Humvee had lost their hearing except me. So it was kind of this weird submarine feeling of I can't communicate with anybody. You know, everyone's yelling. And eventually, the IED had damaged the right rear wheel of the vehicle. And so it took us a while to figure out the state of the vehicle and to put out the fire. But eventually, after driving back and forth for a while, we were able to get back to our patrol base. With no casualties, although everybody had lost their hearing.
Now, you're right that after that event, you experienced, if I have the term right, apophenia, which is – well, why don't you explain?
Apophenia is the perception of meaningful connections and unrelated events. So after the IED went off, I began thinking about various aspects of my experience before the IED went off, which the day before – I hit this IED. I was out on a patrol, and the soldiers I was with said, "Hey, sir, have you ever been blown up before?" Meaning, had I ever hit an IED? And there was this really awkward pause because everybody knew that that was really a bad question to ask, and everybody got mad at that soldier for asking me that question because, you know, I hadn't hit an IED yet, but now that was all going to change. When I look back on that event, that question kind of seemed like a warning. It seemed like the universe had sort of had kind of created, had built this design that included me hitting an IED the next day.
We're speaking with David J. Morris. He was a Marine infantry officer who did not see combat, but then was a war correspondent later in Iraq and struggled with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. He's written a book about his experience and PTSD. It's called The Evil Hours. What are the typical symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder?
Your typical post-traumatic stress disorder survivor is dealing with three things: hypervigilance and hyperarousal, feeling amped up all the time, an emotional numbing, feeling like you can't really feel anything except anger and sadness, and then a variety of intrusive symptoms like nightmares, hallucinations, hearing things, seeing people who aren't there. So there's sort of three major symptomatic areas that are typically defined as post-traumatic stress disorder.
And one of the things you write is that it appears people suffer from PTSD more intensely if they experience a trauma in which they have no control, as opposed to situations in which they do have some control.
Yeah, and the helplessness is one of the main predictors of who's going to end up with PTSD and who doesn't. And the idea that you have absolutely no control over your environment is very hard for people to deal with, because you are basically completely helpless and unable to control your destiny and your survival, and that tends to cause people to experience greater distress in the long term. So, we sort of assume that PTSD is sort of the realm of soldiers and veterans, when in fact the most common and most toxic form of trauma is rape. You know, a soldier might have some control over his or her environment. They might be able – they have a weapon with them. They can move. They can take cover. But oftentimes in the cases of rape, the victim is completely overwhelmed and trapped and cornered. And from the moment the attack begins, they are rendered almost completely helpless, which is interesting. And you see that in the diagnosable rates of who gets PTSD and who doesn't. Rape is, in a manner of speaking, five times more traumatic than combat.
You have a fascinating section of the book where you talk about treatments of PTSD, including your own experience when you were struggling with its effects and went to the Veterans Administration system. Let's talk a bit about that. First of all, you get into a kind of therapy called prolonged exposure, PE. Explain what this is and how it's regarded by the Veterans Administration.
Prolonged exposure is one of the VA's leading therapies, and it's based on the work of Ivan Pavlov, the Russian physiologist. And the idea behind PE is basically it treats PTSD as, in a way, just kind of a learning disorder. And the idea is to get you to tell the story of your worst trauma over and over again in the presence, in the comforting presence of a therapist. And the idea is if you keep telling the story and keep repeating it, eventually the story will lose its traumatic charge and it will seem almost as if someone else is telling the story. So it will become just like all your other memories.
And so you told the story of this horrific explosion in a Humvee again and again in greater detail. Like how many times?
Dozens of times per day. I was asked to tell the story of my IED attack in Sadia. So I figured I told the story at least 100 times to this therapist.
And how did that affect you?
It was interesting because at first it forced me to remember it more. And so I was able to make some connections and understand some of my feelings at the time. But for me personally, after a while, I found that telling this story activated all of my memories of being in Iraq. And I could feel my blood getting hot. I could feel my physiology changing as I was telling the story. I found that it actually activated a lot of the old memories that I'd had about Iraq, just living near close to death for months and months and months. And I think that was sort of one of, the therapy didn't work for me. But it does work for a lot of people, and there's a lot of research behind it. But for me, I found that focusing on just a single traumatic event really was beside the point, because I had, I had lived with one unit that had been, we'd been mortared every day for 7 days straight, but we didn't talk about all those traumatic events, all the stuff, all the death, near-death experiences I'd had for the weeks and months before my worst IED attack. So being forced to tell that story just activated all these memories and just put me, it had the effect of putting me back, putting my body back in Iraq, even though I was still living in the United States.
We should talk about medications. There are some drugs that are used to treat PTSD. The most common is propranolol. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. How does that work?
Well, propranolol is not actually the most commonly prescribed drug, but it is a really fascinating drug that some people have called the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind drug. And it's a very common heart drug, a beta blocker, that basically suppresses the human adrenal response. And researchers have found that they can alter the memories, emotionally charged significant memories, by asking a trauma survivor or asking a person to relive that event and then giving them propranolol, which will change their body's adrenal response to that particular memory. It doesn't always work. They found that it works in about half the time. You know, the research on this is still pretty early, and we don't have it kind of all nailed down yet. But it's interesting because this drug, in theory at least, holds the potential to basically erase huge amounts of trauma in the human race, which raises a number of questions. Like, should we, you know, how do we deal with someone, you know, who might have committed a crime and, you know, is going to have to testify about it and can take propranolol and change the nature of their memory of, you know, a really significant event? So propranolol is kind of this, feels almost like a science fiction drug when you start looking into the implications of it.
You know, in the book, literally in parentheses, you say that you personally think alcohol in moderation is one of the best PTSD drugs ever invented, and you find other survivors agree. Why is that in parentheses?
You know, I guess I was a little worried because it is sort of a controversial thing to say. A lot of people totally don't deal with their memories and the memories of their trauma by drinking their way out of it, you know, and drinking themselves into a kind of numbness. And I'm not recommending that. But I think taken in moderation, you know, I really like alcohol, and I like it so much that I still want to taste it, so I rarely have more than two drinks a night because I want to keep my tolerance down. Alcohol is a great anxiety reducing drug, and I think if you manage it correctly, like you're supposed to manage any medication, you can derive from it great benefit.
You describe after you came back from Iraq. You say since 2004, you trust people less. You worry that life is random. You drive slower, eat out less, you walk carefully over broken asphalt, avoid crowds, don't go to action movies. When someone's following you on the sidewalk, you'll stop sometimes and let them pass. You still that way?
Sometimes. I notice on the street, I did that the other day. I still have in the back of my head kind of this itch on my skin if I feel like I'm being followed by somebody. So I still have sort of these you know, glimmers of like paranoia or something, which I'm okay with. I've kind of come to peace with this. And you know, one of the reasons, you know, I wrote this book was to kind of come to grips with that and come to grips with, you know, and leave my war service, my military service behind. And, you know, that was sort of the writing this book has been a way of sort of saying goodbye to that part of my life and saying goodbye to a certain version, mythology of myself as this indestructible adventurer, this indestructible war correspondent person. And but for a long time, I thought that sort of thing would, you know, if I survived a war, I would be a certain kind of person. I'd be sort of this this mystic almost who could see through the normal day, the normal scrim of daily events to some deeper reality. And so I've sort of, you know, moved beyond that and accepted that that's, you know, that I don't really believe that anymore. And have moved on to other, you know, other new things in my life.
I have to say there's a beautiful passage late in the book where you talk about what you learned and didn't learn from Iraq. I wanted to ask you, do you have healthier relationships now? I mean, do you feel like you're where you want to be there?
In some ways, I think it's made me better as a person because I'm more interested in people than I was before. You know, when you get addicted to going to war like I did for a number of years, you sort of look at normal life as being somehow less interesting and less meaningful and less powerful. And so you sort of focus on the extremity of life. And, you know, I want you know, I sort of want more from my basic human relationships now, because I realize that, you know, going to war and accepting some of the realities of post-traumatic stress have taught me that, you know, I want to have, you know, we're only on Earth for a short period of time, and I want to have as much experience, and I want to connect with people as much as I can before, you know, with this small period of time that I have. And, you know, living in the shadow of near death can give you that insight. And I felt like that was one of the insights that I got after being in Iraq.
David Morris is the author of the new book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.